All across Wisconsin from Civic Media, this is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
All right. Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense for this Wednesday, February 22nd. Another beautiful day on Lake Wissota. A snowy one. A couple of inches. What would we say? I don't know, maybe 3 inches so far in this first wave, with much more a-coming. And so folks need to really not be fooled by this first wave, to hunker down, because more is going to come a little later. And we will talk to meteorologist Jennifer Fajitsky from Weatherology in just a little bit. Coming up this morning, the Supreme Court race for April is set. We'll talk about Janet Protasiewicz and Dan Kelly getting the most votes on Tuesday and advancing to a showdown on April 4th for an open seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Also coming up in our 7 o'clock hour, we will be talking to State Representatives Francesca Hong and Christina Shelton. They're doing some research on basically the next CRT, the kind of manufactured anger you'll be hearing from the right wing in the coming months or year or two. These are the people who smeared teaching an honest and full account of American history, and now they want to vilify those who want to invest in companies that are conscientious about not polluting or cheating their workers or doing business with some shady actors. So that's all coming up. We're also going to meet with Todd Alba coming up a little later on in the program. And Melissa Kay from locally grown radio WFHR joins us later in this hour. Let's see. We have, if you're watching on Facebook or Twitter through the Up North News pages or Civic Media or Bull Falls Radio on Facebook, you'll see that those notes are scrolling across with the primary results. And our first comment on Facebook already is from Minocqua Brewing Company with the comment, "Yay, Janet." So good for you guys for staying on top of the ball on that. Aaron Zommers is standing by, our producer down in our Madison studio. Aaron, good morning to you.
Good morning. I'm pretty glad that here I'm just starting to see snowflakes. So it's unfortunate that you've already got 3 inches or so.
Yeah, it is. But and in fact, I actually have some early snowfall totals. I was just looking online, and they include Black River Falls is at 5 inches, Toma at 2 inches. Over on the eastern side of the state, Appleton reports 3 inches. In central Wisconsin, Plover at 3.6. So pretty much as forecast for the first wave of snow coming through in that 3 to 5 inch range. But again, there is more, much more to come, probably starting sometime this afternoon. We know that many school districts have already shut down for today and tomorrow. Some have shut down for the week. So check locally with your own school district if that might apply to you. And again, we can't stress enough that if you're going to be out driving today, getting some last errands run before the big stuff really hits, please do take it easy out there. If you'd like to call and tell us how the weather's looking out your window, comment on the state Supreme Court race, or anything else that's in the news that you'd like to share, our phone numbers are 844-967-2789. That's the main studio line in Madison for many of the Civic Media radio shows. But because sometimes different shows air at different times, we have a second phone number for those of us up north, like Chad Holmes and Pat Kreitlow. And that number is 715-388-7155. And you can email us radio@upnorthnewswi.com. That's also our website, upnorthnewswi.com. Up North News being a separate entity from Civic Media, and we'd love to show off what our reporters are working on there, or look for Up North News WI on social media. All right, let's get to the election results. Conventional wisdom played itself out, and as a result, there will be one conservative and one progressive on the ballot come April. And it will be progressive Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz. And the conservative candidate who won yesterday's primary was former state Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly, who was a Scott Walker appointee to the court, who was then unseated when he attempted to run for a full 10-year term by progressive Jill Karofsky in 2020. While Waukesha County Judge Jennifer Doro did well in the Milwaukee suburbs, she was trounced by Kelly in many other parts around Wisconsin. And among the four candidates who were on the ballot, and they were all on the ballot together, Protasiewicz got 46% of the total vote, 46%. Kelly, 24. Doro, 22. And Progressive County Judge, Dane County Judge Everett Mitchell, about 8% of the vote. And that's with more than 95% of the vote in so far. So that means that the two progressive candidates outpolled the conservatives, 54-46, in the primary. But that's no indication of how things will go on April 4th, an election that also depends on turnout that is often quite lower than the November races. Still, nearly 960,000 people around Wisconsin showed up to vote yesterday, which shows the tremendous interest and the stakes that are involved. And coming up after the break, we'll replay a couple of segments from Judge Protasiewicz in her interview with us a couple of weeks back, and find out more about her priorities, how she thinks this race is going to be shaped. Quickly in sports, the only highlight from last night was that the Marquette men's basketball team, now 10th ranked in the nation, overcame an 8-point halftime deficit and won on the road 73-71 at Creighton to continue their hold atop the Big East standings. The Badger men's basketball team is scheduled to host Iowa tonight, unless there's any kind of weather announcement that I'm not aware of yet. All right, when we come back, we'll hear from Judge Janet Protasiewicz, talk more about the state Supreme Court race and other headlines for a Wednesday here on Up North News Radio. We'll be back.
Sleigh bells ring. Are you listening in the lane? Snow is glistening.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
A beautiful sight. We're happy tonight.
Welcome. Just remember in that winter wonderland when you eventually have to move all this snow out of the way to take it easy, to, you know, use your knees, not just your back. Don't overexert yourself. Telling you all this before anything falls from the next wave, simply because all the reports indicate that it's going to be a little on the ugly side out there. So please be careful. Tomorrow, Dr. Kristen Lyerly will be here for her usual hometown health segment at 7:30. And at 6:30 tomorrow, we will be hearing from Democratic strategist Joe Zepecki, who I'm sure will have much to say about the state Supreme Court primary election. And from that election, Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz and former state Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly were the top two vote getters, and they advanced to the general election on April 4th. Right now, conservatives hold a 4-3 majority on the court. Conservatives have controlled the Wisconsin Supreme Court for 15 years. But with a conservative justice retiring, that seat is open. And it gives progressives a chance to take a majority, and they are poised for it based on some of the things that conservatives have done while they've been in power, including stripping away women's reproductive health care rights and attacking democracy itself. And Judge Janet Protasiewicz has not been shy about talking about that. One of the things that makes this court race different is you don't have the same kind of, you know, very vague coded language like, you know, respect the rule of law, or, you know, I'm for law enforcement, or I don't call balls and strike, whatever it is. It's like Janet Protasiewicz is coming right out and saying that in her value system, there isn't anything in the Constitution that says women shouldn't have the freedom to control their own bodies. Now, she'll look at each case on a case-by-case basis, but, you know, in terms of her value system, here's what she says, for example, about abortion rights, starting with Dan Kelly's opposition to them. And at the end, she references both Dan Kelly and Jennifer Doro in this interview we did a couple of weeks ago.
Dan Kelly was on record before the Dobbs decision suggesting that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. He's also accepted the endorsement of groups seeking to end all abortions. I mean, I can tell you I am 100% certain that that ban will stay in place if either one of them prevails in April.
I don't think any truer words could be spoken, that there is virtually zero chance that if Dan Kelly wins the race in April, that this state Supreme Court would then overturn the current abortion ban, which was passed by a bunch of white guys in 1849, well before women even had the right to vote, much less control their own bodies. And so Janet Protasiewicz, not afraid to call it as she sees it. The same goes for democracy. This same state Supreme Court, the conservatives on it, the people who ripped away drop boxes because Donald Trump wanted them to, is looking at this conservative court and saying they could do even more damage if we don't make some changes as to who controls that court.
The stakes are absolutely so high in this race. I started thinking about this race last April, and it is not a cliche when I say I got into this race to save democracy for our state. I mean it. Everything that we care about is on the line, and everything that we care about is likely going to come into our Supreme Court chamber.
And that's not just drop boxes. That was just one sample. The big one, of course, is gerrymandering. Our maps have been rigged in Wisconsin for well over a decade because other courts, either controlled by conservatives or too, afraid to enforce one person, one vote, have allowed these rigged maps to stand. And more people realize that is cheating, that it ought to be illegal. It probably is illegal, and needs to be interpreted as such. And that this state Supreme Court, this current one, actually took the bad maps from the last decade and made them worse for this decade, starting with the outrageous decision that they wanted the new maps for this decade based off of the old maps, the old gerrymandered maps from the previous decade. There was no precedent for that whatsoever. They could very easily have looked and told the legislature to start anew and to do a better job of abiding by the standards of keeping districts compact and representative and try to ensure one person, one vote as much as possible, but they didn't do that. They did the things that led to maps that right now give Republicans about 2/3 of the members, and that's in a 50-50 state. Cumulatively, Democrats got a few more votes than Republicans. You have to kind of, gin things up a bit for Republicans to get a majority statewide. You either need, in Ron Johnson's case, you need billionaires coming in and running gutter ads to scare enough people to let Ron Johnson squeak out the closest victory ever, or you have to move the lines around in the legislative and the congressional districts. It's why, again, despite Wisconsin being a 50-50 state, there are two Democrats representing Wisconsin in the House of Representatives, and all the others are Republican. Even though there are plenty of Democratic voters in that area, and, in the case of the 3rd Congressional District, you had a race that was extremely close, demonstrating, again, how purple this state is. So you have Kelly. We did put out a request for an interview. We did not hear back, but Kelly said last night that the campaign is starting all over at ground zero, in his words, and having a conversation with people all across the state. I think he said they are going to be passionate about supporting their constitution and protecting it from being overturned by someone who is trying to put her thumb on the scales of justice, Kelly said, taking a dig at Protasiewicz. Protasiewicz campaigned, as a supporter of abortion rights and said that the maps were rigged. She said as much in this Associated Press story that is wrapping up the race here. Kelly held off that challenge from Waukesha County Judge Jennifer Doro. Kelly cast himself as the only tested conservative in the race. Now, frankly, there were so many people who thought that when Jennifer Doro got in the race, that, she would immediately have an advantage because of the name recognition she got from all those many weeks of television coverage of the Waukesha Christmas Parade trial over which she presided. And to put it quite frankly, she tried to ride the coattails from that case into an office that she almost certainly was not considering before this high-profile trial. she did herself no favors by having her very first TV ad somewhat ghoulishly use the Waukesha Parade tragedy right off the top, rather than, you know, talking about herself first and then leading into the trial. She did herself no favors with potential independent and swing voters based on her own past record, which included the way that she applied to Governor Scott Walker to first be appointed to the court, and talking about her conservative credentials and her feeling that Lawrence v. Texas was one of the most wrongly decided Supreme Court cases. Well, Lawrence v. Texas is the one that says government can't come into your bedroom and can't come into the bedroom of a same-sex couple and invade their right to privacy. And government can't say that what these two consenting adults do in the bedroom is their business and not government's business. Government can't say that that conduct is illegal. And so Jennifer Durrell probably missed any window to take advantage of her name ID. Now, a lot of folks in conservative circles are not thrilled that Dan Kelly advanced, because he did lose and he lost handily to Jill Karofsky in 2020. Kelly has contended and continues to claim that that's only because there was a presidential primary on that same election day. And if that hadn't been the case, he would have unseated Karofsky. But again, this is supposed to be a nonpartisan race. So if you're going to win statewide, you need to appeal statewide. Dan Kelly has no interest in appealing to voters statewide, as we've discussed on this program. He was a paid legal counsel for the Republican Party, the state party, and the national party, as they considered Donald Trump's scheme to overturn the election through coming up with a fraudulent slate of electors, turning in fraudulent paperwork, and then very nearly having that plot succeed on January 6th during a joint session of Congress. Dan Kelly was one of those folks, as the play says, in the room where it happened, in terms of being looped in on those discussions, as being paid by the Republican Party. And so folks will, from this point forward, see a record amount of money coming in to remind people that Kelly is a Republican. There will be all kinds of money coming in to paint Janet Protasiewicz as the most, you know, lefty liberal imaginable. And then it will be up to voters themselves, and especially those independent voters who look at gerrymandering, who look at women's health care rights, and decide who they think should sit on the Supreme Court when they make that choice April 4th. But in the meantime, the money that's about to come in is going to be depressing. As we've noted here previously, right-wing billionaire Dick Eline, who put tens of millions of dollars into racist ads that dragged Ron Johnson across the finish line, is going all in on Dan Kelly. He put in more money prior to yesterday's primary than all the other candidates combined with all of their donations, money that he put into one political action committee. I think it's Fair Courts America or some, you know, one of those generic names. That's going to run probably some of the most shameful ads that you can imagine. And we've had some really shameful ads in state Supreme Court races in Wisconsin's past, looking at you, William Gableman. Now we'll see what they, what the right wing is capable of running this time around. So when those ads run, just keep in mind, no matter what ad it is, if the ad does not come from the candidate himself or the candidate herself, you've always got to ask yourself, does that check out? And we're going to try to talk about those ads. We're going to try to talk about the claims that are made in them. We'll talk about the claims made by the candidates as well. But my point being, all this outside money is going to come in ads that cannot be controlled by the candidate, you know, unless there's some illegal coordination going on, looking at you, Scott Walker. But, you know, then we got rid of the Government Accountability Board and weren't really able to test that theory any further, were we? But unless there's some kind of coordination going on, the independent ads will stay independent. They will make all kinds of claims. They will have names that sound like apple pie or sound generic, but you won't always know who's donating to them. And a lot of voters are going to feel a bit overwhelmed. And so we hope that you come back here on a regular basis. We'll talk about the ads. We'll talk about the claims. We'll tell you, you know, our perspective on it. And then you ultimately make that choice by everything that you read, by everything that you hear. We just hope to be one of those because, again, outside groups spent more than $9 million just before the primary. And it feels like they're going to spend that much a day over these next 6 weeks. More coming up in just a bit. You're up north.
Walking in a winter wonderland.
Follow Up North News online anytime. Search Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for Up North News WI and our homepage, upnorthnewswi.com.
Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead.
All right, here we are at 6:30 on a Wednesday and working our way through the week here past Election Day. And again, if you are just tuning in, Janet Protasiewicz and Dan Kelly were the two candidates who advanced to the general election. And that will be on April 4th. You were mentioning, Aaron, before, and I wanted to clarify something that Dan Kelly said, and I meant to say it, and I didn't in the last segment, how he says he would not have lost to Jill Karofsky were it not for a presidential primary being held on that day in 2020.
Yeah, to me, that sounded a whole lot like, gee, people cared to go out and vote because it was the president, and so they didn't vote for me, and if fewer people voted, then I would have won. So that sounds a lot like he'd rather no one votes.
Oh yeah, exactly. It's again, you've got an entire political class that, you know, is trying to make it harder to vote because they know that it makes it easier for them to win. And it's a heck of a way to run a party, you know, as opposed to winning on your ideas and on your candidates. I learned a little something yesterday, thanks to one of my favorite folks on Twitter. What's your view on whether Election Day should be a holiday?
Me personally, I think it absolutely should be.
I have always said that as well. I've said that for a long, long time. And I now have to reassess that because, again, somebody that I really respect on Twitter, who is a works in a county clerk's office herself, she goes by the Twitter name That Clerk Rachel. And I just gobble up everything that she writes. And she puts it out this way. She says, I get a phone call today. Best friend, are you busy at the moment? Me, not at the moment. Best friend, I'm putting you on speaker. Explain to everyone why you think Election Day as a national holiday is a bad idea. So I did, she said, and they were convinced. And so here's what she had to say. And again, I wish I would have thought this through. I'm still not sure exactly where I am on it, but she wants to make sure you take into consideration the following. Election Day as a holiday will likely disproportionately benefit those who already face the least obstacles voting and has the potential to make it more difficult for those who already have significant burdens when voting. Who gets holidays off? It's not retail or restaurant workers or other low-wage workers. Public transportation runs on reduced schedules on holidays. Schools and daycares can close, making parents have to find alternative arrangements. The post office doesn't deliver mail, so there's one less day for mail voters to return absentee ballots. Voters may need government IDs or documents to vote, and they're not going to be able to get them if government offices are closed on Election Day. There's nothing, she concludes, that Election Day as a holiday aims to solve that wouldn't be better solved with simply expanding access to mail voting and early voting. And I know this is the radio, but I'm going to make the sound of my head exploding. Because I thought, you know, she really is right. And I still want Election Day to be a holiday. I feel like it should be this day of service, of patriotism or whatnot. But when you think of what that actually means to the voters and how if you just made it easier to vote early and vote by mail, that would do what you want it to do. Again, I don't mean to sound over dramatic, but I never thought of it that way.
I didn't either. And makes me feel kind of dumb in just like, well, that's obvious. Obviously, yeah, no mail. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, maybe another way, aside from a flat tax to benefit all these millionaires, is to give maybe a tax credit to businesses if they let their employees have off to vote or something. I don't know. Maybe that's a terrible idea. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. I think anything that we talk about that makes it easier for people to vote, more convenient for people to vote, is a good thing. Everybody thinks that in countries that value democracy. Let's get more people to vote. Think of all the people on the Republican side of the ledger who were very happy. Remember in Iraq that first election, you know, after Saddam Hussein was gone and everybody had their purple fingers that they dipped in the ink, and everybody was so happy about that. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I could have gotten all the details all botched up there. But, you know, the point being, we were celebrating democracy coming back to a country in that part of the world. And yet some of those same folks are working so hard to make it harder for fellow Americans to vote, and instead are doing things like, I'm just going to read the headline because it's just gross. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson is fundraising off the Ohio train disaster. The senator, who received donations from the rail company responsible, is suddenly pretending to care. On Monday, Johnson sent out an email from his campaign account with the subject line, "Have you noticed the silence around the train derailment too? I fear we barely know the impact this disaster has caused. Nearby wildlife are dropping dead, fish are dying up and down the Ohio River, and this is probably just the beginning," said the Johnson email. "We need answers, and we need them now, but the media is barely covering this." Narrator, the media is covering this. But apparently Johnson hasn't kept up to date with, you know, the myriad of outlets that have been covering this story, actively covering it. If there's any silence, it's Johnson, the new Republic writes. It's Johnson who has been part of it. He probably was silent about that part. The senator's Twitter accounts have posted nothing about rail policy generally. And despite his best efforts to pretend otherwise, the senator does have a history of exhibiting anti-worker and anti-rail safety concerns. Last year alone, Ron Johnson received $7,500 from Norfolk Southern, the rail company responsible for the disaster. Johnson is famous for evading millions in federal taxes and helping other businesses get major tax deductions. One of the few rail-related bills that Ron Johnson co-sponsored was a bill in both the 113th and 114th Congresses, backed by the Association of American Railroads. The bill sought to delay the industry-wide implementation of a monitoring system to help prevent train collisions and derailments. Norfolk Southern is among the companies represented by that association. Ron Johnson does not have clean hands on this issue, and yet it does not stop him from trying to fundraise off of it. And other Republicans have assumed that they have an easy target in Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, in part because he had not been on the scene immediately after the disaster. Two Florida politicians had to get taken to school yesterday by Pete Buttigieg as a result. Rick Scott said something about, you know, how leaders need to show up, get things done, do your job. Secretary Buttigieg pointed out that during the initial response phase, "I have followed the norm of staying out of the way of the independent National Transportation Safety Board. Now that we're into the policy phase, I will be visiting, and I'll need your help, Senator Scott. Will you work with us to toughen accountability standards on freight railroads?" And then there was Marco Rubio, who again tried to score some cheap political points, saying that he is incompetent and focused solely on his fantasies about the political future and needs to be fired. And Pete Buttigieg responded with one of those things that essentially says, "This you?" Because he writes, "The facts don't lie. A letter you signed in 2021 was obviously drafted by railroad industry lobbyists. It supports waivers that would reduce visual track inspections. Now, will you help us toughen rail safety accountability and fines or not? And then Secretary Buttigieg lists a number of things that Congress can do, and that if these politicians are serious about safety, they will join instead of blocking these things that have led to a catastrophe and have led to other derailments and could lead to who knows what else.
It's almost like Pete Buttigieg takes his job seriously, and if you're trying to own the libs, you should probably choose a different target.
I don't know why anybody tries to pick a fight with Pete Buttigieg anymore. I mean, maybe in their bubble, they think it scores some points, but every time he has made an appearance on right-wing media, he has taken them to school. The video clips are masterclasses in how progressive politicians should address these things, not necessarily with fire and brimstone and anger, but with facts and with direct responses that are based in facts. And he's always been right, and he's always left his conservative critic or conservative, you know, interviewer to back away, essentially. So yeah, this is not the guy you should be looking at for this. And you know, the same thing goes for President Biden. People saying, well, he's got time to go to Ukraine, he doesn't have time to go to Ohio. Again, still in the cleanup process, let things settle down. You don't show up at a disaster scene 5 minutes after the tornado. You go when the time is appropriate, and you go not only to mourn any loss, but then to talk about what are you going to do moving forward. And I have no doubt that when President Biden does take some action on this, he's going to be calling out some of these people who have been blocking regulations for so long. Wisco Paul is calling in on the line and wants to talk a bit about making it easier to vote. Paul, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, Pete Buttigieg is smarter than the average U.S. senator and way smarter than Ron Johnson. The only thing I need to know about Ron Johnson, he doesn't like Social Security and he doesn't like Medicare. I think we should have more drop boxes and maybe even go to vote by mail, and that would solve most of the problems. Instead, the Republicans, they don't want to go that route, because if too many people vote, they'll probably lose. So that's just my take on that. I have friends that live in Colorado, and they love to vote by mail. So, but I don't think you're going to see it in this state for a little while. But also, the drop boxes in Madison were just great. You vote, you drop it in a box, they come and collect them, and they're secure and safe, and it made it a lot easier for people to vote. And our country is supposed to be democracy at work, and it should be easier to vote. That's my take on that. And my hats off, I'm going to skip to one last subject you talked about earlier. Congratulations to Janet T. So thanks for taking my call, and you have a great day.
Wisco Paul, thank you so much. Appreciate it. You have a great day as well. One more note in headlines before we then switch into this day in history and music and fun. Democratic governors in 20 states are launching a network intended to strengthen abortion access in the wake of that Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court, which shifts regulatory powers over to state governments. Essentially, the U.S. Supreme Court said we can have this patchwork of state-by-state rules on, you know, women have rights in this state, they don't have rights in that state. Well, these 20 states with Democratic governors are making sure that if it's going to get kicked to the states, at least for now, at their level, they're going to make sure that there are services available for residents of those states or people who come to them. So we will continue to follow what they're doing in terms of, you know, model statutory language, executive orders, other ways they can protect abortion providers from prosecution, ways to maximize federal financing for reproductive health care, such as birth control, and support for the manufacturers of medications and contraceptives that face potential new restrictions otherwise from conservatives. So you see this kind of action happening already at the state level for something that had been a national right for 49 years, until this Supreme Court stripped it away, at least the right-wing justices on there. It just, again, underscores the importance of every presidential election when it comes to Supreme Courts, and of course, the importance of state Supreme Courts, where in this case here in Wisconsin, we elect them directly, and we will have a very clear choice coming up on April 4th. All right, a music break, a history lesson, all on the way before we finish up with this hour. And Melissa Kay joins us next.
Casey Jones, better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind. And you know that notion just crossed.
Yo, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. Don't tell me what you want.
I tried, but we didn't get full on dancing out of Miss Melissa Kay from locally grown radio WFHR. I got a little head bob here and there, but I just know that if my then, let's see, what year is this? 1997. If my then 7-year old and 9-year old daughters, you know, were standing behind me, they'd be dancing like crazy right now because this was the number one song this day in 1997. Their debut single, "Wannabe," Melissa Kay. What would your Spice Girls name be? There was Sporty Spice. There was Baby Spice. I guess you're locally grown. Cinnamon Spice.
Yeah, okay. It's, you know, the red hair.
Gotcha. It's that whole locally grown spice from WFHR. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. I would have been singing that song at karaoke.
Oh, sure. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You are operating on a little less sleep than usual because you were working the elections.
Yes, we had live coverage across our civic media network last night that went from 7 to a little after 10:30 or so. So, yeah, late night for me when I get up at 3.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, we'll try to make these next 7 minutes as gentle as possible here.
Thanks, Pat.
More music notes. On this day in 1993, Radiohead released their debut album, Pablo Honey. And this cut is called Creep. Although,
you're just like an angel.
I'm going to admit here that when it comes to Radiohead, I'm not really familiar with the oeuvre, as they like to say. Maybe you are more of a Radiohead closeted fan than I appreciate.
Well, I've heard a lot of their music, I think, but this song in particular, I do really like.
Okay.
I hope to do a cover of this someday.
Oh, God, we keep building the karaoke list for you. That's awesome.
I like Radiohead. I do like their later on stuff more than this first album, but this is their most popular song by far.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's been redone a lot, too.
There. Now I know. This is the actual birthday for President George Washington. This was the day that Washington State was admitted to the Union. It's in 1889, Montana was admitted to the Union. And then what I think we all can agree is one of the big crimes against democracy in hindsight, North Dakota and South Dakota were admitted as states on this day. Two states. So 4 U.S. senators among them for a group that has a lot more prairie dogs, you know, than they have people out there.
Very true.
But this is what we have right now for, you know, building our 50 states. This would have been the birthday of Steve Irwin, born in 1962. So he would have been 61 today, but he was killed in 2006. Drew Barrymore is 48 years old today. Are you, wow, any chance you're do you catch your TV show at all? I don't even know if it's doing well or not.
Pat, I don't even have TV.
Well, there we go. That makes things a lot easier. Let's have another music clip. 1989, the first ever rap Grammy for Best Rap Performance went to DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Will Smith.
You know, parents are the same, no matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand.
I don't think a song like that would have won for Best Rap Grammy in this day and age. The music has changed a little bit. That was 1989. Also equally puzzling for the 1989 Grammys, the first ever Grammy for Best Hard Rock Metal Performance was awarded not to Metallica, as everybody expected, but to Jethro Tull. He of the pan flute, I think. And
he also didn't even show up to accept his award because he wasn't expecting to get that. And then the record company made billboards to congratulate him, and they said, you know, the flute is a metal instrument with a little carrot that says heavy.
That's great.
Nice try, guys. One final musical clip. Adele's second album, 21, was released on this day in 2011, becoming the best-selling album of the year.
Never mind, I'll find someone like you.
And Melissa, this just allows me to repeat what I said on Monday. I went to a dueling piano bar over the weekend and heard some songs that I really didn't expect to hear from dueling pianos, which, you know, is very upbeat. They try to keep the crowd rocking. No, Adele's Someone Like You was one of the songs that they played. We just looked at each other in our group. We're like, are we being punked right now?
But I'll bet you everybody was singing along.
Oh, all the young folks, it was in a college town. So, of course, they were all singing along. Mm-hmm. And us elders looked a little puzzled, shall we say. Hey, I wanted to ask you before we go, you were giving election results. Do you want to tell us a bit about your impression of the Supreme Court primary in terms of, you know, how Janet Protasiewicz did versus Dan Kelly and the others?
Yeah, we were actually very, very pleased with how things worked out. Janet Protasiewicz carried Marathon County, Wood County, Brown County, out of Gamey County, which was, I think, a little surprising to all of us that with the demographic that we have in those areas, that she carried it as well as she did. And Dan Kelly also dominated in those areas over Jennifer Doro, who, you know, has the name recognition from what has happened here recently. But I think some of the other stuff going on in her background that came to light also hurt her in this initial run.
Yeah, it seems to have done that. And as I'm looking at the county by county map here in the New York Times, for example, let's take Marathon County, where Janet Protasiewicz carried the county with 38%. Mm-hmm. Although obviously conservatives had a higher cumulative vote, Dan Kelly getting 35%, Jennifer Doro 23%. But, you know, there were just many counties, especially as you got further north and west, where Jennifer Doro was hard pressed to crack 10%. You know, in Dunn County, she only got 8% of the vote. So that name ID definitely helped her in some places. She carried, you know, Waukesha County and Washington County, but not much else. And let's see, let me pick on a couple more here. Wood County, again, Protasiewicz carried it 39 to 34 for Kelly to 22 for Doro. Mm-hmm. So I guess that just that tells me that we already knew this was going to be hard fought. It's going to be hard fought state to state or statewide, county to county, is where you're going to see the candidates and see the ads.
Yeah, and a lot of money is going to come pouring into this state. This is, as we were discussing last night, could be the highest spending for a Supreme Court election in Wisconsin.
Yeah, very much so. All right, a couple seconds left. You want to give me any highlights on what you've done or are doing over at Locally Grown Radio?
Yeah, we've got some. We'll break down Wood County today on our morning magazine. Well, I should say James. Well, I'm going to sleep. but move. He will break that down with the vice chair of the Wood County Board, Laura Valenstein. Mm-hmm. And then on Friday, he'll be talking with public schools, I believe the superintendent, Craig Boren, and Julie Kolarik, principal of Wood County Elementary, Woodside Elementary, and possibly discussing the school board there, because that was an interesting race as well.
All right. Sounds good. Melissa Kay from Locally Grown Radio. Thanks as always. Get some sleep. We'll see you next week.
Will do.
Okay. More news at the top of the hour here. Check of your weather, other headlines.